Dear listeners and viewers, in today's episode, we discuss child rape cases, which may be upsetting to some. Viewer and listener discretion advised.
When I was 5 years old, I went to my mother's and sister's house to school because there was no school in my village. So when I went there, when I was 8, the son started sleeping with me. Then when the sister caught him, the sister then reported him to the father. Then the father scolded at him, and that was when the father started.
That was 13-year-old Ochanya Elizabeth Obanje speaking to the press in August 2018. She was narrating how she was repeatedly raped by her uncle Andrew Obuja and his son Victor Obuja starting at the age of 8. Ochanya was diagnosed with vesicovaginal fistula, VVF, and on Wednesday, the 17th of October 2018, 2 months after that interview, she died. Before she died, Ochanya was leaking urine and feces as a result of damage she suffered to her vagina and anus, allegedly at the hands of her cousin Victor Obuja and his father Andrew Obuja. Ochanya's family pursued her case through the court system, hoping and expecting to get justice. In April of this year, 2022, they received this news.
A state high court sitting in Makurdi, Benue State, presided over by Justice Augustine Itoyiman on Thursday, discharged and acquitted Andrew Obuja, a lecturer at the Benue State Polytechnic, Upokolo, of the charges of rape and causing the death of a 13-year-old schoolgirl, Elizabeth Ochanya Obanje, in 2018.
The judge presiding over the case acquitted Ochanya's uncle, Andrew Obuja. And as part of his judgment, the judge is quoted to have said, "It is regrettable that the deceased could not tell her story before she died." And that's where we got confused. There is a video of Ochanya doing just that, telling her story. Why didn't that count?
As a child growing up, she was quite intelligent and wanted the best for herself. And well, her education was everything. And that was why she had to leave the village to live with the Obujas before the unfortunate incident.
That's John Ame, Ochanya's elder brother. John told us that the Obujas are their cousins, and so the family was comfortable sending Ochanya to live with them in order for her to attend school. According to Ochanya, after 3 years of living with the Obujas, their son, Victor, began to sexually assault her. At some point, his sister found out and reported to their father. The father, Andrew Obuja, scolded his son, but then he also began to sexually assault Ochanya. Ochanya said the abuse continued until she fell ill.
I was not feeling fine, so I came back home. I went to Federal Medical Center in Makurdi here. I spent 2 months and 5 days there, so they discharged us. When I now came home, then that was when I told my mother that when I was in my uncle's house, my uncle and his son, they were sleeping with me.
Ochanya's mother, who spoke with Pulse newspaper, confirmed that after being discharged from the hospital, Ochanya fell sick again, and they went to the hospital for treatment, but Ochanya's condition was unclear to them. They later found out that Andrew's wife, Mrs. Felicia Obuja, hid the results of 11 tests that had been carried out on Ochanya while she was still under the care of the Obujas. Ochanya's uncle, Andrew Obuja, was arrested, and on the 10th of October 2019, he was arraigned before a Makurdi High Court. Mrs. Felicia Obuja was also arrested and arraigned at Federal High Court in Makurdi. Their son, Victor, was nowhere to be found.
The process of trying the suspects in Ochanya's case was quite rigorous and difficult, in the sense that Mr. Obuja and his wife were tried at two different courts. While Mr. Obuja was tried at the Benue State High Court in Makurdi, his wife, Felicia Obuja, was tried at the Federal High Court in Makurdi by the National Agency against trafficking.
According to Ochanya's brother, John, the husband and wife were tried in two different courts because Mrs. Felicia Obuja was being charged by NAPTIP for negligence. And NAPTIP is a federal agency, so her case was tried in a federal court. For Andrew Obuja, his charges were criminal and fell under the jurisdiction of the state court.
So it was quite difficult to get the case settled at the state high court. The prosecution presented their findings, I mean their investigation, and then put out the evidence before the court. And then the court, in its understanding of the law and the evidence, said the evidence did not link Mr. Obuja directly to the crime. And coupled with the fact that Ochanya was not in court to testify as to what happened to her.
According to the judge, he acquitted Andrew Obuja because the police investigators failed to test and match his specimen to the medical reports. The judge also said that there were two conflicting autopsy results and he couldn't simply choose one. The first report was from the Federal Medical Center in Makurdi, and that one revealed that Ochanya died from natural causes, while the other was from the Nigerian Police Forensic Laboratory in Lagos, which showed that she suffered diseases that were related to sexual abuse. The judge also said that he had to acquit Andrew Obuja because Ochanya was not there to testify in court about what happened to her.
For us as a family, we see that as a travesty of justice. Owing to the fact that there was a video recording of Ochanya before she passed, and the video recording was played in court where she gave vivid description of what happened to her regarding Mr. Obuja and his son, how she was raped and all that. But the judge turned a blind eye to that. Even after admitting that piece of evidence into the court record.
When we reviewed other cases of rape where the victims were minors, we noticed that there is a pattern to how the courts made their judgments. In one of the cases, an 8-year-old child was said to have been raped by her teacher, and she said that he raped her in the toilet by turning the bucket in the toilet upside down and asking her to sit on it. Then he also came to her house when no one was home and raped her. In this case, the child was able to appear in court where she gave an unsworn testimony, and her testimony was corroborated with evidence. There was no doubt that the teacher went to her house when there was no one. The prosecution was also able to corroborate that there was a bucket in the toilet, and they gave a vivid description of why the defendants would have needed to get the child to sit on a bucket so she could be high enough for him to penetrate. They also had a hospital report that proved the child had been penetrated. So in this particular case, where the child's unsworn testimony was corroborated with evidence, the prosecution secured a conviction. But we also found the case of a 4-year-old raped in her parents' house. The 4-year-old couldn't testify in court, but her mother testified saying that she left the children in the house with the man, but that the children were in a separate room. When she got back home, she saw the man coming out of the children's room. She sensed something was off and went into the room. She found the children's net had been raised up and saw traces of semen. She quickly checked the child's vagina and noticed that there were bruises. Now, even with the mother's testimony in this case, the man was not convicted because the court ruled that the mother's testimony was uncorroborated. The semen was not collected as evidence to be tested, and the child was not taken to the hospital in time for independent assessment. We looked at other cases and the pattern seems to hold. A judge will grant a conviction for child rape cases only when there is evidence to corroborate the accusation. It's clear that a judge will not convict on the basis of a child's testimony alone. They need additional proof. According to Amnesty International, in June of 2020 alone, there were over 700 reports of sexual assault cases. Meanwhile, the National Agency for the Prohibition of Trafficking in Persons, NAPTIP, reports that 32 rape convictions were secured between 2019 and 2020. There's clearly an issue somewhere with securing convictions. And if the problem is about corroborating evidence, then what does that evidence have to be? Does the accused person have to be caught in the act? Do they have to be subjected to medical examination? What if they confess? Does that count as corroborating evidence?
My name is Barrister Amina Umar Hussain. I work with the Legal Aid Council of Nigeria and Assistant Chief Legal Aid Officer. Also, I am an active member of International Federation of Women Lawyers, FIDA, Kano Branch.
To understand why the success rate in securing convictions is so poor, we reached out to Barrister Amina, who told us that the burden of proof for rape cases, like in criminal cases, is on the accuser, who will have to work through the state prosecutors.
Generally, under our law, I mean the Nigerian legal system, always the burden to prove is on he who assert. Any person that says something has happened, the law says he is the one to prove that that thing has actually and has really happened. So in our legal system, rape is a criminal offense. And the burden of proving a rape is solely on the prosecution. What do I mean by the prosecution? You know, criminal offenses are offenses which are committed to the state generally. So the state has its own lawyers that we call the prosecution lawyers. The prosecution lawyers are the one which law place a burden on them to interview their victim or the survivor so that they will gather and come up with evidences. When they do, they are the one that is the state or the prosecution, they are the one that would take the perpetrator to the court.
But before cases even get to the hands of prosecutors, there are certain factors that can hinder convictions from ever happening. The first is cost.
You have to pay. Sometimes the parents are battling with what to eat, so they will opt out of even thinking of prosecuting the cases.
If a parent has to choose between feeding their children and paying for medical tests to prove rape, they will opt out without even thinking about prosecuting the cases.
Secondly, the legal system is very, very slow. It's very, very slow. A case of rape that's supposed not to be more than a few days, it will take years. At a point in time, the wards, the guardian, the parent will just give up and just forget about the cases.
When rape happens to children, parents are often in a state of shock. And the pressing need to make their child feel better or to hide the shame of the rape may make them take certain actions that end up jeopardizing the case for the prosecution.
Maybe your words come in an unusual way, and you checked and find out that she has been intruded. Instead of you doing the necessary thing, you find out the parent has washed the child. By washing the child, you are washing the evidences. Even though the act has occurred, but you have washed the evidence, you go to the court, the prosecution will be battling of how to prove it because you have washed the evidences. You have thrown away the pants. You have washed the stain of blood. You have washed away the semen and everything. So it will be difficult to attend to a successful prosecution.
And it turns out that even communities have an impact in whether a case even makes it through to prosecution.
You see, in a particular community, people know that this person is suspicious. He's not a good man. But people will allow him to be in their mix. Or secondly, when it happened, people will refuse to come and testify that, yes, I know him to be of so-so-so, because there is one thing that we call in law, character evidence. Sometimes it can value and sometimes it can put you in. The society are not willing to help the law.
Another critical factor that hinders the prosecution of rape cases is simply the issue of not having enough courts, lawyers, and personnel to support these cases through to prosecution.
We from the International Federation of Women Lawyers, we have been crying for the government to have a specific court. We call it a court that is purposely established for prosecution of perpetrators of rape case, so that will not be undergoing all this hold up and go slow. Because you have a rape case today, before your case will come up, maybe the court will have to attend to 3 to 5 cases. Maybe they will just give your case few minutes or seconds. Maybe they will just say, take one witness, and that would be all for you. You have to come another day. The judgment that they are going to give you is very long. From there, you lost interest, you lose evidences, you lose witnesses.
Regardless of all these factors, when a rape case finally makes it to the courtroom, there are other hurdles prosecution has to face in order to secure a conviction, especially in cases where the victim is an underage child.
If the child is so young that she cannot give a sworn evidence, then the law says she can give an unsworn evidence. What is unsworn evidence is she will give her testimony without taking an affirmation or an oath.
Now, even though the child testifies, the court still needs corroborating evidence.
What we mean by corroboration is a piece of story that will support what the victim says. Let's say now there is a medical report that shows that this girl has been penetrated. Let's say there is a medical evidence that shows that the hymen has been broken. Let's say there is a medical evidence that shows that there is some bruises. Let's say that there is a corroborative evidence that the mother was the first person to get in contact with the prosecutress. She knows that this is not how her child is. Her child come in an unusual way. Or her child come with a stain of blood. All these are evidences. All these are evidences. And the prosecution can comfortably lead the witness in the court, and the witness can give this evidence, and this evidence will make the court to be convinced that actually the crime has happened. You see, sometimes in proving a case, we don't necessarily need an eyewitness. Sometimes we don't necessarily need an eyewitness. Just like how I tell you, we need circumstantial evidence. Maybe there is somebody that can corroborate to the court that, yes, I saw this girl when she was coming from this perpetrator's room. I saw her. It's corroboration. Let's say somebody saw when he is making gift to her. It's corroboration. Let's say somebody saw her clothes or her slippers in his room. It's enough to corroborate the evidence of this unsworn child.
But the situation changes when the victim is unable to give an unsworn testimony, either because they are too young or no longer alive, as in the case of Ochanya.
In criminal cases, it is very, very fundamental for a victim to testify to the court as to what actually happens to him or to her. And in so doing, that witness or survivor give his evidence under oath. So in a situation where there is no victim, it will be difficult for the court to prosecute, because the person that wants to testify actually that this thing has happened to me is not before the court. So it will be difficult for the court to ascertain what has actually happened, when, where, how does it happen. So these are the kind of things that sometimes in prosecuting this kind of cases, it is good to have the victim or the survivor. He will come and testify and say everything that happened to him, and other evidences will follow. Other witnesses will come forward to support that his evidence. So in a situation where there is no victim, for him or her to tell the court what has happened, it will be difficult for the court to judge. It will be difficult because this electronic evidence, one has to be very, very careful when using them.
This brings us back to the issue of the video recording made of Ochanya as she was speaking to the press back in 2018. Even though Ochanya told her story in that video, there is a reason why the judge had to be careful in relying solely on the video to reach judgment.
You know, the issue of electronic evidence is something that even the court has to use it with caution because of this Photoshop that we have and any other thing. You know, filming Photoshop can create a lot of wonders. And the law says, when proving a crime, you have to prove it beyond reasonable doubt. If there is an iota, a small amount of doubt, a small, no matter how small it is, the court will rule in the favor of the defendant. If now they said maybe it's filming, maybe it's video show, and they was able to convince the court that there are a lot of techniques or means that somebody can use to create this kind of thing, then there is doubt, coupled with the fact that the victim is not before the court to testify.
The stance of the law on prosecution of rape cases, even for minors, even for cases where the victim is unable to testify in court, is that testimony is not enough. The testimony must be corroborated. This means that caregivers and society at large must now know what to do in order to preserve evidence that would help corroborate the victim's testimony. And this begins from the very moment one discovers that a rape has happened.
Don't wash her. Don't clean her. Don't remove her clothes. Immediately take her to the police station as the third step. Take her to the police. Report the matter to the police. If you have paralegals in your society, call them. They will lead you to the police. The police will take on from there as the first stage of taking the survivor or the prosecutors to the hospital. The hospital will try their best to get evidences from there. From there, the police, after making sure that the prosecutress has been attended to, she has been taken care of medically, they will conduct an arrest, which is the fifth stage. The last stage is taking that person to the court. If that person, the perpetrator, is being taken to the court, he will be punished accordingly. And if it is established that he has committed this offense, he can spend the rest of his life in prison. He can even be sentenced to death, but the least he can get is life imprisonment.
When Andrew Obuja was acquitted, the next line of action Ochanya's family hoped for after the acquittal was an appeal. But the power to appeal against the state ruling lies with the prosecution. And in this case, the prosecution did not file an appeal.
The time within which the state government was supposed to appeal against the decision of the state high court has lapsed because it was supposed to be done within 3 months. That has lapsed. That was enough time for the state government, if it was keen on appealing the ruling of the state high court. But it said there were not enough grounds for appeal. So that probably informed their decision. And of course, you know, this case had a lot of political undertones regarding the caliber of persons who were involved in it. So that must have played out in the action of the state government not to appeal. The decision of the state government not to appeal against the ruling of the lower court.
As far as the High Court of Benue is concerned, Andrew Obuja is a free man. On the other hand, Mrs. Felicia Obuja, Andrew's wife, who was tried for negligence, was convicted at the Federal High Court.
The Federal High Court convicted the wife on the same set of issues. In fact, the court found that Ochenya was indeed raped, and the wife heeded all that transpired in the house. It was on that basis that she was convicted. So we'll be wondering why the principal culprit in this kind of heinous crime would be left to go free, while someone who has played a role from the sideline was convicted. So that leaves a sour taste in everyone who deserves justice.
The ruling of the Federal High Court acknowledges that Ochanya was sexually abused while under the care of the Ogujas, but the State High Court's ruling says that the prosecution failed to establish beyond reasonable doubt that the abuser was Andrew Ogbuja, as alleged. The case against Andrew Ogbuja cannot be reopened, but there is one last hope for Ochanya's family to get what they believe to be justice.
The only thing that can happen in this case is if there is further investigation and Victor Ogbuja, who has been on the run since the incident happened, can be put on trial.
As of this recording, and based on what we know, Victor Ogbuja is still on the run.
Hi, everyone. If you are angry after listening to or watching this episode, we want you to channel your anger towards educating everyone around you that the number one thing that must happen in cases of all rapes, whether it's a child that was raped, an adult, boys, girls, men, or women, the first thing that needs to happen is preserve the evidence. It's the only way that we will hold these people accountable. It is the only way that we will begin to eradicate them out of our system one by one. You heard Barrister Amina talk about ways you can do that. Don't take a shower. Don't bathe. Don't even wash your hands. Don't throw away the clothing that you're wearing. Take yourself exactly as you are to the nearest police station. The police must attend to you. But if they don't, go to the nearest hospital. It's very important that some professional sees you, collects information, and examines and tests you immediately. Special thanks to Mr. John Ame, Ochanya's older brother. May the Lord Almighty bring you and your family peace. Thank you to Barrister Amina for sharing your wisdom and experience. And we want to thank all the lawyers, civil society organizations, and doctors who deal with rape cases day in and day out. Your contributions are priceless, and we hope that you find healthy ways to manage your own mental health. The Backstory is a Triple E Media production. Production copyright 2022 Triple E Media Productions. If you enjoyed this episode of The Backstory and you would like to hear more, go to our website at 234audio.com to play the sample content. Then download our app from the Google Play Store for even more episodes. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at 234audio to watch the video for this episode. Make sure to click the notification bell, like, and leave a comment. Our episodes can also be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe, like, and leave a comment. This episode of The Backstory was produced by Antonieta Kalunta, Uche Mba, Dominic Tabakaji, and Sam Tabakaji. Executive Producer Ramat Mohammed. Special thanks to Miriam Mohammed.